You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Coming up on the program, a conversation with the author of a new book about the namesake of McCarthyism in the United States, and a look at how some local colleges and universities are planning to educate students on campus and off in this world of COVID-19. But first, a conversation with the winner of yesterday's special election. Political newcomer Justin Wright beat state lawmaker Timothy Cassina yesterday in that election for Woodbury County Supervisor in District 2. Wright is a Republican and he teaches at North High School. Wright says he would like to help do things like fixing county roads, which could be expensive. But Wright also says the county could improve things like social services without necessarily needing to lay out a whole lot more money.
I think there's an opportunity maybe to address food insecurity in our area. I think there might be a way to address access to mental health services, to child care services. I think there might be an opportunity to improve in the communication that exists here locally between individuals and organizations that provide those resources and the people that need them. I really want the folks that voted for me and those that did not vote for me to hear me and believe me when I say, let's talk about ideas and let's talk about how we can take us from where we're at right now to a better place. And let's try to do it as quickly as possible. I really believe that there are opportunities around here to do that.
And you are a newcomer to politics. You beat a state representative. At least he's been a state representative for a couple of terms. A person who's, you know, Tim Cassina, long known in the community. What was it, do you think, that in your message that resonated with people?
I'd like to think that people trusted what I put out there, that I shared about my background. I really believe that it was not hyperbole when I talked about, I've been doing a lot of work in the community for a long time. And while I have not served in any kind of a formal role, I've already invested a lot of resources. And I think the people that know me best, I think, knew that about me. And I think that they believed in that aspect of my message with enough confidence that I think I had a lot of people that went to bat for me and talked to friends and neighbors and just shared that, you know what, this guy is on the level, and his faith in Christ is something that motivates him to try to make to try to serve other people in the area. And I would like to think that that's what it was. But I also know that...
And you're going to be sworn in next week at the supervisors' meeting, right?
Yep, it sounds like I'll be sworn in next Tuesday. And I've been out this morning already. I've tried to pick up a good portion of my signs. I committed to people that I'd get out as soon as possible. We don't want those things marring the landscape any more than they have to. And so I've been out there picking those up this morning. And I think I got about half done. I think maybe I have about 50 more I need to get around and pick up in the next day or so. But I want to hit the ground running and fulfill the commitment that I've made to serve. And I'm excited to try to make that happen. So thanks for your time, Mary.
That was Republican Justin Wright, who won yesterday's special election to fill the vacant seat on the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors. He defeated Democratic State Legislator Tim Cassina for that seat. Unofficial results show Wright picked up 53% of the vote over Cassina. More than 9,000 voters, or about 16%, took part in the election. 90% of voters cast absentee ballots to fill the remaining term left by Supervisor Jeremy Taylor. Taylor stepped down after issues arose over his residency. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. While the COVID-19 pandemic disrupted higher education with colleges and universities trying to navigate through a new normal that keeps changing every day, Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer talked to the leaders of Western Iowa Tech Community College, Morningside, and Briarcliff University in Sioux City. They explore the fallout from the outbreak, educational impact, and what is potentially in store for the fall. We'll start with Dr. Terry Merle, the president of Western Iowa Tech Community College, who was interviewed late last month.
COVID-19, I don't think anyone saw this coming and the impact that it would have.
Absolutely not. We certainly didn't. And even probably 3 months ago when we converted over our spring semester to online, I think our initial thought was this was going to be a short-term response. That was 3 months ago, and we're far from short-term.
And I know even just working here, I appreciate the fact that you've restricted, you know, who comes onto campus. I think that helps a lot of us do our jobs a lot easier, knowing that, you know, we all have to get temperature checks. Actually, you're doing the interview in person, but you are wearing a face shield, and we are more than 6 feet apart. Yeah. So that's good. But I think that that's really appreciated, at least, you know, being a staff member, knowing sure. that extra protection is there.
Sure. You know, I've been in education for many years. The one thing that's important for education to happen is people have to feel safe and secure. And I think certainly in March where we were, people did not feel that. And I feel like it's my role as we look at reopening the campus, and we have had nobody on our campus for the last 3 months other than employees. And for part of that time, very few employees were here. But I have to do everything I can to try to make people feel as much as possible that we're doing everything that we can for them to be safe and secure as they're on campus. And July 1st, we're going to open up and allow visitors on campus for the first time. We won't have any classes on campus until August, but it'll be quite a change for people as they come on July 1st than when they left the first part of March.
And when it comes to the fall, it sounds like you're going to try to do something in a flexible type of way.
Yeah, we're calling them flex schedules. You know, we traditionally have face-to-face classes and online classes, and we've done something that we've called blended or hybrid before, where it's kind of 50% online, 50% face-to-face. And now we're kind of into what we're calling a flex course, which is a portion of your time will be done in classroom and a portion of your time will be done online. And that may flex depending upon what's going on. As we went through our building, you know, our traditional classrooms in education, what you try to do is you try to get lots of people in a classroom, have lots of chairs, lots of desks. And as we've tried to go in and make it safe and secure for people as they come back into education, we can't fit that many people in a classroom. And so, you know, what may have been traditionally a 30-person classroom may only be 10 to 12 people in there now. And how do we then work that same class, giving people the face-to-face that they want? You know, and before we started, you kind of mentioned that I can do telephone interviews, but I really like face-to-face. And I think there's a lot of people who say, I can maybe learn some online, but I really like and I really want need that face-to-face. So how can we create that face-to-face environment for those who want and need it, but then also do as much of the online or virtual learning as possible as well, so that we can make sure we keep that campus safe and secure as much as possible.
But it's hard for you because a lot of your programs, they're very hands-on.
They are.
And how do you work with that kind of challenge?
Well, each faculty, so I want to be careful because faculty have a lot of ability to look at their particular course and do what's right for their course. But a class that might have been a traditional heavy lab course, we'll do like a welding. There might have been 20 people in a welding lab. And now we may only have 8 people in that welding lab. And instead of your lab being from, you know, maybe a 2-hour period in the morning, we'll make it now to where there'll be maybe 3 or 4 different labs, each of which being 2 hours. And so our lab will be utilized a heck of a lot more as far as time frame, but then there won't be near as many people in there. So it'll require more people hours to staff it, more faculty time to be able to be there for the student and grade it. But I think where we can keep people at that, I guess, distance that you need, social distancing, but also not near as many people on campus. We were at about 3,500 people on campus a day before all of this. And we know we can't have that many people on campus all day, every day, like we did before. So we got to figure out ways to spread people out, not only distance-wise, but also time-wise. We may be doing more afternoon classes than we've ever done.
You know, with the financial uncertainty of people's households, you know, people maybe being afraid to leave Sioux City because if they get to a bigger university and then a second wave of COVID-19 happens. And are you seeing that? Are you predicting maybe you might have more students this fall, or is that still kind of up in the air?
Well, predictions are very difficult right now.
That's true.
because I don't know what next week is going to look like, and certainly not next month. And every prediction I think we've made has probably gone miserable. But I think in our models, as we've taken a look at it, I can give you a model where we could have a significant reduction in enrollment. And I can give you a model where we could have a significant increase in enrollment, one of which you mentioned. People are maybe leery about going off to school because of a resurgence and then maybe being called back. We also know we have one of the highest unemployment rates that we've had in a long time. And traditionally, when you're unemployed, you start thinking about future and what do you need to do. And education and training tends to be a big part of that, thinking about that. So there's a couple of things at play that could really say we could be inundated in the fall. But there's also then the uncertainty of, you know, we're seeing certainly for this summer, people just decided to say, I'm just going to hold off on my education and not do anything. And that could potentially happen if we get a resurgence of COVID closer to the fall start. We may see a lot of people say, I'm going to sit out for a year, or I'm going to do something different. And so when you put it all together, I have no idea what that means other than we need to do the best that we can do to be prepared for as many students who come to us in the fall.
I know the University of Iowa, they say they're hurting. Mm-hmm. I believe it was a $25 million budget reduction they need to do. How about Western Iowa Tech? How are you guys doing financially?
Well, we're never doing well enough. I don't think you can ever talk to an educator who says, we've got as much money as we need, don't worry. But, you know, we've done some things that we've needed to do. An interesting thing, in the spring, we had a greater retention than we had in the fall. So in other words, when COVID came, we didn't see a lot of people who dropped out because of the fear of what was going on. We were able to make a pretty smooth transition. Now, every one of our students do get an Apple laptop, so we were able to move virtually fairly seamlessly. Now, obviously, there's always kinds of individual circumstances on that. So I feel pretty good about at least about where we're at. The legislature just concluded and they didn't take money away. And that was a big fear. You know, the state obviously is not taking in as much tax revenue. And so what was next year going to look like? So I feel comfortable that with the status quo that we're going to be able to be okay. And quite honestly, we did some early retirements in fear of what was the budget going to look like in the fall or that was pre-knowing what the legislature was going to do. You know, we're just trying to take it a day at a time and trying to make sure that we can create that safe environment as much as possible for our students. You know, there have been a lot of extra expenses. I've bought more hand sanitizer and wipes and facial shields. And, you know, we're buying plexiglass barriers, way more tape to put tape on the ground than we've ever, you know, done before. And we have more staffing as far as our security. When our employees come in, you have to have a facial covering. And we take everybody's temperature to make sure that nobody's sick. And if you're sick, go home until you're better. And if you think you might have COVID, then you need to go in and do the whole app and find out if you need to be tested. But all that takes a little bit more staffing. So we haven't had a reduction in force, but we've moved lots of staff to different areas so that we can try to cover everything that we need to cover. So it's a crazy time. In my 20-some years of education, this has been by far the craziest.
And it has to be pretty stressful. I could not imagine, you know, just having to be the leader of so many different people and so many unknown variables out there.
I think it's stressful for everybody. You know, I can't think of a, you know, maybe an author who always stays home and writes on their computer and never leaves and are still doing the same thing. But everybody has been asked to change the things that they do. And, you know, my position's no different. And I'm just trying to look out and try to figure out what's going on. And that's a very tough thing to do. You know, in many ways, I at least have more control as far as trying to decide what it is, what's the right thing to do and what's not. Although the government tells us what we can and can't do. And certainly the governor closed down the state, which closed down schools and closed down some other things. And so it's just an interesting time and probably more stressed than normal, but I probably won't feel that for a few years. I think school's going to look a lot different when we come back in the fall. You know, we've spent probably the last month moving furniture on campus. And so all of our commons areas, we've moved out a lot of furniture because we used to have chairs close to each other, tables close to each other, and we've tried to move that. I've mentioned that our classrooms are going to be different. When you come this year, it's going to be a flex schedule. It may look a little bit different from time to time, but you're going to get that face-to-face instruction that you want, but you'll also get that opportunity to do some things at home. And we think it's going to be able to bring the best of both worlds when students come in, and we're ready to help our community and help our students reach their goals and take us to hopefully some type of post-COVID reality, whatever that is.
John Reinders, President, Morningside College. Well, I think the impact really started last February. We were, I think for all of us, I think caught off guard. We quickly mobilized the campus. The first thing we had to do was bring our students that were abroad home. We had 14 students in Italy in our semester in Italy program, and we had other students scattered literally across the world. So the first order of business for us was to safely bring those students home as quickly as we could. And it was soon after that that we realized that in the best interest of our students and their safety, that we moved to remote or distance learning for the second half of the semester. And so we did that as well. So it really, it's kind of like Groundhog Day. Since March, it's been the same thing. The campus has been pretty empty. And students, the second half of the semester, finished their year last year remotely. And we didn't get to have graduation. We didn't get to have spring sports. So it was quite a bit different.
And now you're looking towards the fall. You're actually going to start a week early. Is that correct?
We are. We're going to open about a week early. And the reason we're doing that is really twofold. One, I think it's important for us to minimize the number of times that our students have breaks and go home and then return to campus. I think we're all a little fearful. And this is really happening across the country. Colleges and universities are doing everything they can to keep their students on campus. And so we can contain the number of people that they come in contact with. The other thing is, I think at Thanksgiving, when we send them home for a longer period of time, we thought it would be far better if we, once we sent them home, just have them stay there.
Now, I know Morningside College over the years, your enrollment keeps increasing every year. What was the enrollment like last fall, and what are your projections for this fall?
Even though we're going to be just about what we were last year. We were around 1,200 undergraduate students last year and about 1,500 graduate students. And we expect to be just about the same for this coming fall. Now, there's a whole lot of time between today and when they arrive in August. But as we sit here today, it looks as though we're going to be right on track for that.
And your first day is August 19th, I believe.
August 19th.
According to the calendar
day.
I looked at.
One of the things I wanted to mention, I think as much negative and hurt that's been part of this pandemic, one of the things that's happened is I think it's reaffirmed for both parents, for students, and certainly faculty and staff at the college, just how important face-to-face education is and how the intimacy of an environment like ours is so important to students' growth. I can't tell you the number of times I've heard from parents and from students and our faculty how much they miss the interaction that happens at a place like Morningside. And sometimes we grow over time to take that for granted, but I think this has reaffirmed that small colleges like us have a very important place in the higher education marketplace.
When it comes to the economy as well, I know some of the big universities in the state of Iowa, they're dealing with millions of dollars they have to cut from the budget. I think the University of Iowa, they're looking at up to $25 million that they're short. How are you guys doing financially as far as COVID-19? Did it make an impact on you?
Well, certainly there's additional expenses that came with that. We had to offer students refunds second semester last year for the unused room and board portion of their time when we sent them home. We had a number of other expenses this summer already in plexiglass and in hand cleaner, any number of things, face masks, just all kinds of stuff that we are getting ready to make sure that the college is in place safely for this coming fall. What role testing is going to play in this, we don't know yet, but I'm sure testing will be a part of the strategy that we employ once the students are back and we have our full faculty and staff back on campus. So the expenses just keep coming, but the priority for all of us is to make sure two things, that we have a safe environment here and that the students get the maximum educational experience we can possibly offer.
And the pandemic's actually impacted you. You had planned on retiring, but that changed your plans.
It did. I was going to retire. This would have been my last year. But it really, to run a presidential search right now would have been very, very difficult. And I think the continuity and leadership and the team that I have is important at this time. So my wife and I agreed with the executive committee of the board of directors that in all of our best interest, it was good to stay one more year.
I know many people are very fond of what you've done for the college. I graduated way back in 1992. And at the time, the college, we didn't know it at the time, but it was undergoing such financial turmoil behind the scenes. And the enrollment was way down. And I look at, you know, the numbers of students now and what I've been hearing as far as what Morningside's doing in the community. I think a lot of people credit you for what's been going on there.
Well, that's very kind, but it isn't me. I have this marvelous team here. I've been blessed to have great folks that work here. And I think together with the faculty, the staff, and the best board of directors anybody, any president could ever hope for, I think collectively we've worked together. This was just a little bit of a tarnished gem for a while. And it just took all of us to buff it up a little bit. And Morningside's just thriving right now. And I think it's going to continue to thrive in the decades ahead too.
I know you credit your team for some of the success, but do you think it's maybe how you recruit students? I know you guys do recruit a lot of student athletes. I don't know if that kind of plays into the picture of the success of Morningside, plus the successful teams as well. I sound like I'm a big promo for your college, but I'm actually stating facts.
I appreciate that.
I'm stating facts.
One of the things that I think, we hired a new marketing director a couple of years ago by the name of Erin Edlund, and she has brought to this campus this notion of experience matters. And I don't know if all of the students that come here now are going to be involved in something experientially from the very moment they step foot on campus. There's actually a requirement now. So we have kids out in the community job shadowing, doing internships and externships right away. There's one required in their first 2 years and another one required in their last 2 years. And I think it's that combination of real-world experiences coupled with just an extraordinary classroom experience that has set Morningside apart. And those two things combined, and Erin's done a marvelous job of getting this message out there on a number of different platforms. That's why I think our applications have soared. That's why the alumni, and they're connected to this in any number of ways, they're connected back and are giving students this experience or opportunity. Talking to students, mentoring students that are here now, but that's really changed the culture of the place. So I credit that. That's, I think, the biggest change that I've seen, and I think that's going to be important for years ahead.
Rochelle Carstens, president at Briarcliff University. In the past 3-4 months, it obviously impacted not only the teaching modalities that we were using. We moved from a primarily in-person classroom setting to an entirely remote online learning environment back in March. It also impacted and affected our residential community. We did actually have many of our students remain on campus for various reasons. We never did technically shut campus down or require everyone to go home. So we have always had some students on campus. The number has varied depending on the time of year and, you know, reasons that they need to leave, etc. It obviously has impacted workers. We moved to an entirely, or primarily, I guess, remote work environment in March as well, with the exception of our essential workers on campus. And then, of course, we're making plans moving forward to minimize and mitigate risk.
What's your plan for the fall?
So as you can imagine, the plan is a plan within a plan within a plan. But our plan is to reopen this fall with safety measures in place, along with health screenings, temperature checks, and things like that. We've been working with Siouxland Public Health as well as some of our higher education organizations have issued guidelines and recommendations. And so we're really just analyzing and incorporating as much of that as makes sense and is applicable to our situation. I would say the most fluid piece of it right now is primarily athletics. We're still awaiting final guidance and recommendations from our national athletic organization, but we are planning to open in the fall with safety protocols in place.
Will you do anything virtually as far as teaching, or will you try to do everything in person?
Oh, no. We actually are utilizing what we're calling high flex, which is a hybrid flexible model. So we are doing some of our courses in person. We're doing some of our courses online. Some of them are a hybrid. And then for everything, we're maintaining flexibility so that if we need to move to an online environment like we did in the spring, we will be much more flexible and prepared than any of us were back in March.
Everything is just kind of uncharted, wasn't it?
Oh, uncharted, unprecedented. I was saying several times to my team, I felt like I was shoveling snow in the blizzard with a heated spork. Just, you know, every time you turn around, new information and the information you relied on yesterday was no longer reliable. And just very challenging, very challenging.
What was your enrollment last fall? And do you have any projections on what you might expect for this upcoming school year?
I apologize. I do not have my enrollment numbers in front of me, but from a projection perspective, we are actually cautiously optimistic. The numbers are indicating that we will actually have a bigger incoming class than we did last fall. But again, there is always that possibility of summer melt. And so we are just adjusting our methodologies and our connections and working hard to continue to recruit. And we'll see what happens come fall. But we are actually cautiously optimistic right now. But who knows? I mean, things have been flipping in a matter of 24 hours in this country. So we'll see what happens between now and August.
Do you think a lot of families want to keep their students here, their children here, instead of sending them to a university setting in a bigger city where they might have to cut classes early and sending everyone home anyway?
We're actually hearing the gamut, right? We have some local parents. Yep, we want our student to stay here, commute, stay where it's relatively safe. We have other parents who are like, no, I want my child to go to college and stay there until they come home. You know, every situation is different. Some families and homes have immunocompromised family members. And so once they send a student off, they need that student to stay in that location. So it's just, we're hearing all of it.
I know we're also hearing about, I know at the University of Iowa, they're looking at trimming, like, I believe $25 million that they need to save because of the money that they didn't have coming in. What are you seeing at Briarcliff? Mm-hmm. What kind of economic impact are you guys hit with because of the pandemic?
You know, I think it's safe to say that everyone has been impacted by this pandemic economically and in so many other ways, right? We're still await because of the nature of the cycle of higher ed, we won't know the full impact until later in the fall, because it is so cyclical with a fall, you know, with a fall start date and then the spring. I mean, a lot of our budget for what happened last spring was already in place, right? So that really remains to be seen, what the full impact will be. But of course, we're preparing for all contingencies as much as we can.
Also, were you working, like you said, on that budget before this all hit to try to maybe streamline things and cut costs?
Well, we're always working on the budget, right? But we had to do a major pivot and shift once COVID hit. And so we actually have, much like our plans for fall opening, we have several tracks of our budget, again, depending on what ends up happening. I mean, there are some national estimates that are saying between 10 and 20% in reduction of enrollment because of COVID-19. We'll see what happens, but we're preparing for all of that. I did want to go back to your earlier question about parents and the decisions that they're making. We are also hearing, though, that they feel like Briarcliff is a good choice because we're relatively small. Our community also is pretty isolated up on the cliff, and so they feel like it's really a safer option. And of course, we're doing everything we can to incorporate those safety protocols for when students do return.
You just heard the presidents of Briarcliff University, Morningside College, and Western Iowa Tech talking about the impact of COVID-19 on the way they teach students and more. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, these days, there is a lot of talk about the demagogic style of President Donald Trump. Historian Reinhard Luthen defined a demagogue as a politically skilled person in oratory, flattery, and invective, appealing to the passions rather than the reason of the public and arousing racial, religious, and class prejudices. Republican Senator Joe McCarthy embodied most of those traits. McCarthy was the catalyst behind the Army-McCarthy hearings. Known for alleging numerous communists and Soviet spies and sympathizers infiltrated the U.S. federal government, universities, the film industry, and elsewhere, people across the country were riveted to the wall-to-wall television and radio coverage of those hearings in 1954. Here is Senator McCarthy at one of those hearings in the spring of that year.
Once you have this United States, from the Atlantic to the Pacific, covered with a network of professors and teachers who are getting their orders from Moscow, from an organization that wants to destroy this nation, that wants to corrupt the minds of youth, then we are rapidly losing the battle.
Larry Tye is the author of a new book called Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. Tye says while Trump and Joe McCarthy had very different backgrounds, they both have become known as demagogues and sometimes bullies.
Yes, so I actually only mentioned Donald Trump in the preface, in the epilogue, and that's intentional because this is a book about Joe McCarthy, but I think that there is no question that Donald Trump borrowed his playbook. On a day-to-day basis, you see it in terms of everything that Joe McCarthy stood for and everything Joe McCarthy did. And that would be sort of pure speculation and just looking at what Trump said and what McCarthy said if there wasn't a human through line. And that human through line is Roy Cohn, the young, aggressive, brilliant, probably amoral attorney who was Donald Trump's tutor and half a century before was Joe McCarthy's protege. And he took all the things that he had learned from Joe McCarthy and quite consciously passed them on to Donald Trump.
Looking at the two, I'm thinking to myself, you know, and I'd heard of Joe McCarthy's childhood before in Wisconsin. You know, he was raised in a relatively modest home with Irish Catholic parents, not a lot of money. But Joe McCarthy was very determined to rise above all this and really make good, wasn't he?
He was, and from a very early point, he made clear that part of doing that was getting the affirmation of his fellow Wisconsinites by running for office and winning. And he tried doing that at a young age, running in a very brash campaign for district attorney. He was at that time a liberal FDR New Deal type, and he ran as a Democrat. He realized that in his part of Wisconsin, he couldn't get elected as a Democrat. So he not only turned himself into a Republican, he turned himself into the iconic figure for the most conservative forces in the Republican Party. So from New Deal liberal to very conservative Republican without a blink of an eye or any embarrassment at that kind of flip-flop.
I was just interested to see how McCarthy went from being someone who finished high school basically in, I don't know, a matter of 18 months or something like that after raising chickens and doing eggs and all that, sort of his own business as a teenager. And then he moves on to Marquette, goes to college, goes to law school, has all these jobs. I mean, he's someone who always seemed to have another idea to sort of finance his future. I mean, he seemed to never be at a loss.
Yes. So he was, if you were a McCarthy fan, you would say he was incredibly enterprising, the perfect young entrepreneur who turned himself into a chicken tycoon, who turned himself into an elected official at a very young age, and who showed that he had incredible chutzpah and incredible ability at making things work. If you were a McCarthy cynic, you would say he did whatever it took to get ahead, and that could be changing political parties, changing ideologies, or basically embellishing and lying his way into office, which is also something that he did quite effectively.
Yeah, well, he also was in World War II, and he's sort of known as Tail Gunner Joe, and people, especially journalists, have wondered whether or not, and said this wasn't necessarily true, that Joe McCarthy never went up in a plane, never was in battle in World War II, but you say that he was.
His World War II military diaries, his real-time diaries that when he was in the South Pacific, he was keeping, they showed that rather than tail gunner, the notion of him being a tail gunner being an exaggeration, that while he was, his official duty was as a land-based intelligence officer, he volunteered to go up and fly in perilous missions as a tail gunner, and that all the things that he had said, that journalists said, were embellishments, if not outright lies, were in fact true. And that is what happens, I think, when over time you develop a reputation as an embellisher or a liar, when you're actually telling the truth, nobody believes you.
When he got back, you write about when he gets out of the service and he starts running for offices, he becomes a district judge, you know, and then he seems to have a pretty quick progression in these smaller offices to running for the Senate. And when he runs for the Senate, he takes on a big family in Wisconsin. And I don't know if a lot of people today talk about, the La Follette family. I think you used to call him Fighting Bob La Follette, and they were the Kennedys of Wisconsin kind of thing.
They were. So in Massachusetts, we know this dynastic family that I wrote my last book about, the Kennedys, that they had extraordinary power, and running here as a Kennedy carries extraordinary weight. In Wisconsin, at least as powerful were the La Follettes. There was the senior La Follette. They called him Fighting Bob. There was his son that they called Young Bob. And between the two of them, they had held the seat for more than a generation. Between the two of them, they looked unbeatable. And between the two of them, it looked like a quixotic, if not an idiotic thing, for Joe McCarthy to take on Young Bob in this Republican primary. McCarthy did it. McCarthy ended up getting the backing of what was known as the stalwart Republicans of Wisconsin, the most conservative Republicans, who hated La Follette, didn't especially like Joe McCarthy, but realized that this was the young guy who was ambitious and entrepreneurial enough that he was the guy that they were going to throw their cards in with, and it turned out to be a brilliant move. He beat La Follette in the primary. He went on to win easily against the Democrat in the fall, and he showed up in Washington as arguably one of the least unprepared people in that year of the Senate to take office, and yet the brashest and most successful politician. And Washington found out pretty quickly that Joe McCarthy was more than a force to be reckoned with.
You know, I read in your book that they thought of McCarthy as, quote, you know, a gas bag and a pretender. But once he sort of got the bit in his mouth about communists in this country, that, you know, he realized that this was something really important, right?
So absolutely right. But it took, so he showed up in February of 1950 in an out-of-the-way place in Wheeling, West Virginia, with two speeches in his briefcase. The occasion was a Lincoln Day dinner, the ultimate Republican annual celebration of Abe Lincoln's birthday. One speech that McCarthy has in his briefcase is a snoozer of a speech on national housing policy. And had he picked that speech out that night to deliver, you and I wouldn't be talking about him half a century later. Instead, he delivered a barn burner of a speech where he said, I have in my hand a list of 205 communists at the State Department and riddled throughout our government. And while he couldn't produce the names, and while the list wasn't real or wasn't meaningful, it was perfect for the moment. It was a moment where we were in the middle of a Cold War. It was a moment when Americans wanted a simple answer to what the problem was. And McCarthy said the answer was, behind every pillar at the State Department, there was a red. And he was going to name them, and he was going to expose them, and he was going to root them out. And who cared whether he did it? That night, every reporter in America decided that he was worthy of their front page.
How long from the inception of this was it until we get to the hearings?
So till we get to the most famous Army-McCarthy hearings,
right.
It was from February of 1950, a full 4 years later. And during those 4 years, Joe McCarthy had become the poster child for anti-communism in America. He had become the second most popular politician in America, with a full 50% of Americans endorsing his program, and the only person in the country that outweighed McCarthy when it came to public opinion was the President Dwight Eisenhower.
It, obviously, though, a lot of people in the country were very afraid, if not anti-communist, afraid of communists, right?
They were, and I think legitimately so. This isn't the book that's attacking. While I think we went overboard with our anti-communism, this isn't the book that's attacking the premise that the Soviet Union posed a threat to America in that era. The premise that I think we ought to be questioning is whether or not there were communists infiltrating our government, not the Soviet government, and whether or not Joe McCarthy had any clue who those anti-communists were. And most serious anti-communists that I interviewed for this book said the single worst person during that era for their movement was this false prophet, Joseph McCarthy.
I feel like he really tapped into a deeply ingrained fear with people. And I think if you can do that, obviously, you can make a lot of headway.
You can. We see today, we've seen with all the demagogues who came before Joe McCarthy and the ones who came afterwards, that if you've got a fear that you're building on and that you're tapping into in the American psyche, and if you've got a compelling and simple answer to that fear, people buy it. The fear was legitimate that communists were going to take over the world, and the simple answer was, I'm going to point out the traitors to you, and we're going to solve the problem. And people, for a long time, for those 4 years that we were talking about it, they bought it. But the day they stopped buying it, almost overnight, his popularity plummeted. He went from the beginning of 1954 at 50% to, at the end of the Army-McCarthy hearings, to 34%. Overnight, the bottom fell out. Overnight, people said, not him. He's not our prophet.
Those hearings where he was accusing people connected with the Army of being involved in this communist plot, and that was where the famous quote was, right?
So the quote was from Fred Fisher's senior associate. Fred Fisher was a young lawyer.
Oh, okay.
McCarthy was accusing of having communist ties. Joe Welch, Fred Fisher's senior associate in Fred Fisher's firm, had a line that he was aching to deliver, and he was waiting for just the right moment. When McCarthy took off against his young associate, Fisher said to him, "Senator, have you no shame?" And that is a question that much of America had wanted to answer, and that the other half of America, the half that supported McCarthy, really started looking at him in a new way. And the guy that they saw coming into their living rooms on these television sets that they were addicted to night after night looked not like a hero. He looked like a town bully. And that's what they saw him as by the end of the hearings.
But what about all the folks that went to jail, lost their jobs? Were they rehabilitated fairly quickly? I heard a lot of them, it took a long time for them to sort of get their lives back.
Yes. So I have a whole chapter in the book that looks at exactly that question. It revisits the lives of McCarthy's targets, and it finds a couple things. It finds that some of them never could rehabilitate their career and their reputation. They had been smeared, and a smear sticks, and the jobs that they lost, they never got back. It found that others had suffered for the rest of their lives, that they had had this sense that they were somehow not in the mainstream, that they were not to be trusted. And it found that a small percentage of them actually committed suicide, that they took their own lives. They were so devastated by what happened to McCarthy. And McCarthy used to say all the time, point to one person who's really been hurt by what I've done. And I wish he could read that chapter, because there were thousands of people who were hurt, and there were dozens of people who lost their lives.
Yeah, and I think that sometimes it's easy to forget about what happened to them because you get so involved with the story of this man.
So it's really disturbing, and what it raises is a question, and a question that lots of historians would disagree with me on. I think it raises the question of why the one person in America who could have taken down John McCarthy earlier and who knew how dangerous he was, and that is President Dwight Eisenhower, waited almost 2 years to do anything about him. And Dwight Eisenhower's brother, a very smart guy named Milton Eisenhower, was whispering in his brother the president's ear for a year and a half, saying, give up some of your popularity, take on that demagogue McCarthy. And Dwight Eisenhower didn't do anything until McCarthy overstepped his limits, until he took on the all-powerful U.S. Army. And then Commander-in-Chief Eisenhower, who loved the Army, stood up and said, you know, McCarthy's a bad guy. And I think that he could have done it earlier. He knew how bad McCarthy was, and he wanted to wait for McCarthy to do himself in, and lots of people suffered in the meantime.
That old saying about, you know, for evil to triumph, just good people doing nothing, isn't that the saying?
Exactly. So that's exactly true, and the good people were partly senators and the president. The other good people were the half of the American public who supported McCarthy, and in the end, his number one enabler was the American public.
He did not live much longer. He died in 1957. He'd always been a big drinker, smoke. He wasn't exactly an ad for a healthy lifestyle. And so people maybe weren't too surprised when he died. But I remember reading in that book you wrote about Bobby Kennedy, and, you know, he and the Kennedys have been, from what you say, you know, good friends, and they did things together as families. They knew each other very well. And after he died, that Bobby Kennedy, and I don't know exactly if I'm saying this right, didn't he show up and kind of come in the back door at his wake?
He did. So he showed up at the funeral. His brother Jack, who wanted to run for president and wanted to win the Democratic Party's nomination, didn't want little brother Bobby showing up at the funeral of the arch-villain Republican. And so Jack Kennedy said, don't go. And Bobby said, thanks for that advice, and he went. But he stayed on the plane until all the other dignitaries had gotten off. When he got to the funeral, he went up into the loft, up into the balcony, so that nobody would see him. At the graveside service, he stood off to the side so nobody would see him, and he went up to all the reporters he knew there and said, I beg you, you'll get me in trouble with my brother Jack if you print my name among all the dignitaries who were there. And I heard this story from one of the reporters who 50 years later was trying to look for absolution for having left Bobby Kennedy's name out of a story that he knew that name should have been in there. And Bobby Kennedy, if you like Bobby Kennedy, you say he showed his loyalty to Joe McCarthy, who gave him his first meaningful job by showing up at his funeral. If you don't like Bobby Kennedy, you say Bobby Kennedy was not this great iconic liberal figure. He was, in fact, a coal warrior, started out as a coal warrior of the same stripe as Joe McCarthy. But one of the other interesting things is all the coroner's records and all the newspapers said that Joe McCarthy died of acute hepatitis. For some reason, somebody in the military decided that they were going to turn over to me a box of 1,000 pages of McCarthy's medical records when he was treated at Bethesda Naval Hospital. And what he died of is what you said, not what the public knew at that time. He died of acute alcohol poisoning. He died of being a drunk. And it was very sad. From the day that the Senate censured him at the end of 1954 to his death nearly 3 years later, McCarthy was a destroyed guy. He had always been a heavy drinker, but he became an alcoholic. And in the end, that killed him.
You know, you were talking about Bobby Kennedy, and I remember when I was a kid, Bobby Kennedy, you know, going to, you know, see the poor in Appalachia, visiting poor neighborhoods in the Bronx in New York. And he was sort of known as, you know, a liberal for the people. But the thing was, he was someone who would had a laser sort of focus on someone if he went after that person. I mean, he was dogged, and he did not let go, right?
He did. He didn't. And some people said that the that he showed a kind of ruthlessness in the way he went after people, and that was very reminiscent of Joe McCarthy. But it was interesting. The two of them were on exactly the opposite political trajectories. Bobby Kennedy started out as a Cold Warrior and ended up as a liberal icon. Joe McCarthy started out as an FDR New Deal liberal and ended up as a Cold War icon. And they were sort of passing in the night. Their intersection, thanks to Papa Joe Kennedy, to Jack and Bobby's father, who had always loved Joe McCarthy. Joe McCarthy was connected to Bobby by Papa Joe, and they had enough in common that Ethel Kennedy is the one who got me Bobby's widow, who got me intrigued by Joe McCarthy. Ethel Kennedy said, "Joe McCarthy might have been a monster to much of America, but to us, he was a joy. He was fun. He was the guy who played with our toddler daughter." And she got me thinking about Joe McCarthy in an entirely different way, thinking there must be something to this guy that was charismatic and charming for more than half of Wisconsin and for half of the country to buy into him. There must be something. And there was. He was every bit as vile a public figure as our image of him. But he's a guy that you and I would probably have loved to have gone out and had a beer with, because he was a great storyteller and a great charmer.
That was Larry Tye. He's the author of a new biography called Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. Well, that's it for this edition of The Exchange. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks to Sheila Brummer and also to Steve Smith. I'm Mary Hartnett. We'll see you next week.